This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, February 4th, 2003. When President Bush delivered the State of the Union address on January 28th, not only was it in capitalist doublespeak, it was the expression of total class war on a global scale. He disguised the real objectives. He concealed the nature of capitalist rule. And today in Taking Aim, we're going to look at what capitalists are doing across the globe. In fact, we are in their sights. The global class war targets working people. Ralph?
Maya, we discussed the enormity of the crime that's about to be inflicted on the people of Iraq. And the reports that we were citing under the heading Shock and Awe described the plan to strike Iraq with 800 cruise missiles within 48 hours, which would be more than were used in the entire 40-week period of the first Gulf War. On the 2nd of February, the New York Times disclosed that the Pentagon's war plan is an enormous increase from that. 3,000 guided bombs and missiles in the first 48 hours of the opening air campaign, begins the article on the 2nd of February in the New York Times. The initial bombardment will use 10 times the number of weapons fired in the first 2 days of the Persian Gulf War, and as they stated before, more in the first 40 hours than the total Gulf War itself. And the air campaign carried out by about 500 Air Force attack radar jamming and support planes scattered from bases throughout the region. This is on a scale that can barely be imagined. And it should be noted that the Washington Post, in elaborating upon this, made clear that the U.S. war planning has reached its final phase, contained in a secret national security presidential directive, putting the Pentagon in charge not only of the military campaign, but of the occupation of Iraq itself, a unified authority under General Tommy Franks, the theater commander for the war.
The countdown has begun when Secretary of State Colin Powell goes before the United Nations on Wednesday. The question will not be if, the question is when. Across the world, everyone is in agreement throughout the press and throughout the military analysts, among the military analysts, that the U.S. will not take no. It is, as the New York Times says, the forces are in place to strike. And what are they going to strike? As Ralph had mentioned, bombarding Baghdad, putting it into smithereens, essentially. And we have here on February 2nd, Joe Dillon, who's the deputy political editor for The Independent in Great Britain, says that Iraqi water and sanitation systems could be the military target, according to the Department of Defense, the Ministry of Defense in Great Britain. And she says explicitly, the Ministry of Defense yesterday admitted the electricity system that powers water and sanitation for the Iraqi people could be a military target, despite warnings that its destruction would cause a humanitarian tragedy. Despite warnings that they're creating a humanitarian tragedy, what is the target? The electrical capacity, the sanitation, the water. Once again, to destroy Baghdad, to target the people of Iraq.
And that is the meaning of the report in the Washington Post on the 26th, which summarized an analysis by an international team, and the study was called The Impact of a New War on Iraqi Children. Death, disease, and starvation, begins the Washington Post article, await Iraq's children when war breaks out. 13 million Iraqi children at risk. That means that the destruction of potable water, of electricity, of the means of distributing food in a country that is already devastated by epidemic disease and the consequences of the sanctions. Iraqi Children, the report says, are more vulnerable than ever, worse off than they have ever been. Faced with a new war, the consequences are unimaginable. The report concludes, it's a genocide in preparation.
Now, the cost of this genocide, of course, will be borne by the Iraqi people with the destruction of the infrastructure of their country and also the attack on their national sovereignty. But the economic costs of the war in Iraq, as we discussed in the report by William Nordhaus, the Yale professor, are going to be extreme for the people here in the United States, too. And following up on William Nordhaus' important study that said the cost to people in the United States could be as high as $1.9 trillion, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which is funded by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation primarily, the chief economists there, Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot, did a further analysis of the Nordhaus study. And they concluded that there could be a loss of 1.6 million jobs just this year, 2003 to 2004, here in the United States, with an average of 300,000 fewer jobs each year over the next 7 years, 2005 to 2011, as a war-related oil shock sets in as a result of this travesty of attacking Iraq, the seeking control over the oil resources of the Middle East and gaining hegemony over the peoples of the Middle East.
Maya, one of the other aspects of this war is that it's not just Baghdad that is targeted. The article in The Observer in London on the 2nd of February makes clear that the city of Tikrit itself, merely because it is the hometown of Saddam Hussein, is going to be leveled. A devastating bombing campaign targeting Tikrit, and the article details the intent to reduce it to rubble. This is a plan on the order of the firebombing of Dresden. They are already announcing in advance what they plan to do to the cities, to the targets, to the civilian centers. And in that regard, we had discussed the microwave HPM radiation weapons that are in store for Iraq, as disclosed by the Denver Post. Now the Aviation Week and Space Technology publication, which is an authoritative military publication, elaborates upon the microwave weapons that are intended to be used throughout Iraq, and in particular, how these high-power microwave weapons will be in fact carried by each cruise missile. The Frieden-Pulitzer-Rotschlag in Germany exposed now that an attack on Iraq will see the use of high-power microwave weapons that produce a split-second spike of energy that will destroy all electrical and electronic components that power water systems, that power electrical systems, that power sewage disposal systems. They will use from cruise missiles and from unmanned aircraft, and they will be done throughout Iraq as a demonstration of the new experimental HPM and microwave weapons, all of which have radiation effects that will replicate the consequences of the depleted uranium that also coats these weapons.
Now, again, let's look at what this means here in the United States, because it is not only a class war, a war of devastation against the people of Iraq. Under cover of this war is it's a war against the peoples here in the United States. We have, for instance, the cruise missiles, the Predators, the vast arsenal. What does this mean to the Bush cronies in the defense industry?
Miami, if I might just say, before we move into the war on working people in this country, war in Iraq is but the little beginning. And we have discussed how seven countries have been targeted. Indeed, Rumsfeld had talked about two-thirds of the United Nations. But I want to mention, before we move to the United States, the disclosure in the Washington Post about the slip that Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, made. As they said, he let the cat out of the bag. After Iraq, North Korea is next. During a torrid question time in the House of Commons last Wednesday, focused on his government's support for U.S. attack on Iraq, when Labour Party backbenchers were heckling Blair as to his support for an attack on Iraq, Blair blurted out that after Iraq, they're going after North Korea. If Pyongyang fails to take the lesson of the attack on Iraq, a military campaign against Iraq is already prepared. And the New York Times amplified this by disclosing that Rumsfeld has ordered preparations for an attack on North Korea to follow the war in Iraq. General Leon Laporte, the commander of American forces, is now in South Korea. Rumsfeld, in his meeting with Laporte, made clear that the U.S. is preparing for a military assault on North Korea. It is permanent war on an enormous scale. We can only begin to indicate what the consequences will be for our people in the United States.
Permanent war, and the costs of this permanent war are borne by the people of the United States. Not just unemployment, but the destruction of the social safety net, and under cover of war, the institution of legislation such as the U.S. Patriot Act and Homeland Security. But let's look at some of the costs, the direct costs of this permanent war in terms of what's called defense, but is really offense, the military budget. Right now, the military budget is 17% of the total federal budget, $348 billion. Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon plan that and have stated openly that in order to fund the occupation of Iraq, in order to fund all the weaponry that is going to be needed in a multi-front war, because remember, U.S. forces are in bases in 100 countries throughout the globe, they will need at least $500 billion, half a trillion dollars in open military spending. Remember, there are other categories that aren't open. Now, this will be more than half of the discretionary spending of the federal budget for the military, because aside from what we call discretionary spending, there is funding that is mandated, such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, military retirement, civil service. So that the bulk of the funding, the discretionary funding outside of the mandated social service funding, is going to go towards the permanent war.
Maya, you know the doublespeak that characterized the State of the Union speech by George Bush is characteristic of the way capitalist politics works. They invoke categories that they consider to be of concern to the people of the United States, whether it's the pollution of the environment or the precarious condition of health care. Many of you, brothers and sisters, will recall the invocation of hydrogen cars as an alternative to fossil fuel cars, which the Bush speech elaborated upon as if to suggest that oil was not the main object of their exercise in Iraq. Here is what the New York Times disclosed on February 2nd, a green car that the energy industry loves. Mr. Bush's new initiative for fuel cell research is not as Birkenstock-friendly as it might appear. In his State of the Union last week, Bush seemed to embrace the holy grail of the environmental movement, a push to the so-called hydrogen economy. But because hydrogen fuel cells produce nothing more than water vapor, the production of hydrogen will be environmentally harmful, the New York Times continues. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, but it doesn't exist naturally on Earth in its pure form. Just as the oil is locked up in the Middle East, hydrogen is locked up in compounds, said Robert Rose, an executive director of the Breakthrough Technologies Institute and a leading advocate of hydrogen fuel cells. But in reality, 96% of this hydrogen produced in the world comes from natural gas, oil, and coal, the same fossil fuels that the environmentalists seek to abandon. So in short, the Bush administration is investing in the petrochemical industry, and the source of hydrogen fuel will be natural gas, and an enormous boondoggle for the oil companies that are, of course, the main capitalist prop of Bush and Cheney and co. Hydrogen fuel, petrochemical industries, boondoggle. And the same with respect to the reference to AIDS. AIDS, after all, as the London Times disclosed in its extraordinary front page article in 1987, the emergence of AIDS clusters in Africa correlate in a one-to-one portrayal of the vaccination programs inflicted upon the peoples of Africa, just as they are now being forced upon the people of the United States. But these vaccination programs for anthrax, for smallpox and the like in Africa are the precise locations where the AIDS clusters emerge. And when the Bush speech refers to AIDS and the supposed aid that will be coming to the victims of that epidemic disease in Africa, it is the drug companies and Eli Lilly who will be the beneficiary. The people won't be able to benefit. The drugs will not help them, and the cost will be enormous. That's the real thrust of capitalist misspeak, invoking categories that concern people to profit the capitalists who prepare the lies.
If you listen to President Bush and you listen to people in the current administration, you would think that the United States is in a state of prosperity, when in fact this war is covering up one of the long-term recessions that economists now admit they should have seen but didn't. And again, if you go to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Dean Baker did a study called Dangerous Minds, the Track Record of Economic and Financial Analysts, in which he looks at the collapse of the stock market bubble and what it would mean if U.S. workers had had their pension funds more so invested in the stock market, because many pension funds on a global scale, such as the state pension funds, California being the largest, are invested in the stock market and lost tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in the collapse of the bubble.
$10 trillion of actual value was lost. $10 trillion, and what I think we should make an important a statement about this, to the namely that pension funds, when they're placed in the hands of the stock market, you're putting these pension funds and health care provisions in the hands of the capitalist speculators, who then take them on in off-the-books trades, profit enormously, and then everything collapses.
So what Baker notes is that if the savings plans that President Bush is now proposing and that had been discussed by both the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of privatizing Social Security, if that had been in place, workers would have lost much more of their retirement than they had in the 401ks. In fact, the workers would not have any retirement, not just from the collapse of Enron and the other companies that were devastated by their gross speculation and financial misdeeds, but that millions of older workers who have already lost retirement savings, many, many, many millions more, would have been devastated had the privatization schemes of Social Security that once again are on the table been enacted several years ago. Ralph?
Maya, one of the other keynote elements of the Bush doublespeak in his State of the Union was the avoidance of double taxation, as he referred to the corporate dividend tax. Of course, a tax on corporate dividends does not represent double taxation, since the corporation is not an individual. It's individual salaries and individual profiteering that is taxed, and the corporate taxes are quite separate thing. But the real significance of this is the following. The New York Times had already anticipated this on January 8th in an article by Michael Janofsky called States Fear the Double Whammy from the Tax Plan. President Bush's call to eliminate taxes on corporate dividends, a centerpiece of his economic plan, has raised alarm among state and local officials who say it will add to the growing budget pressure on collapsing states and cities. The provision on dividends will cost state and local governments billions of dollars a year in lost revenue. The states will lose in two ways. Because state income tax laws are tied to the federal law, the removal of the tax on dividends means that the states will have to stop taxing them as well. And the removal of taxes on dividends will result in the collapse of municipal bonds. Hence, the sole tool for sustaining social programs, and namely municipal bonds, will be rendered virtually illegal, which is perhaps the hidden collateral goal of the Bush plan.
Ralph, it's a good thing you mentioned the myth of double taxation, because this was a primary myth promulgated by President Bush in the so-called State of the Union address, because his own new Treasury Secretary, John Snow, had been the CEO of CSX, which is the large rail company. Now, it's important to know that they definitely are the benefit of privatization, because it's CSX that through the changes with privatization and subsidies to the rail company that became the huge conglomerate that it is today. And it's pointed out by Citizens for Tax Justice in their excellent studies on the meanings of the so-called plans of the current administration, which in many ways are supported by the Democratic Party senators and congressmen too. And he says CSX paid nothing at all in federal income taxes on its $934 million in U.S. profits over the past 4 years. Instead, it got tax rebate checks from the Treasury totaling $164 million. Obviously, CSX's profits can't possibly be double taxed, is the conclusion of Citizens for Tax Justice, because CSX, like many of the corporations in the United States, doesn't pay taxes. But in fact, what Citizens for Tax Justice does note in their headline is that the Bush 2003 tax plan, a big fat zero for a third of the nation's taxpayers. Percentages with no tax cut are much higher in the poorer states. Now, the $674 billion tax plan is a gift to the wealthy. A total of 64 million taxpayers, as calculated by Citizens for Tax Justice, almost half of the nation's total, would get less than $100 from the Bush plan. 45% of this tax benefit goes to the top 1%. And we used to say the top 1% own 90% of the wealth, but the income inequality in the United States has grown so much that right now the top 1% of the people in the United States own 95% of the wealth. Now, and they are going to benefit, to get 45% of the benefit. If you look at the top 20% of the wealthy in the United States, they get 72% of the so-called benefit. One last thing. Let's be a little specific. What does it mean in the state of New York, for instance? In New York, the average for the top 1% of the people in the state of New York, their income tax return is going to be $48,239, while most of us will get nothing or at most $100. In California, it's $35,940 in just the first year. Now, I mean, really, look at this. This is so openly, so flagrantly a gift to the people who elect the ruling class.
The people who fund the ruling class, Maya. But your Your revelation is important. In this program, we have repeatedly cited the Department of Commerce statistics, which were prepared under the Clinton administration, which showed that 2% of the population owed 90% of the wealth. Now we find that it is 1% that now owns 95%. It is a 100% increase in this concentration of capital and concentration of power in the hands of a tiny ruling class. I don't think that people can fully comprehend what this statistic discloses, that this ruling class is shrinking in its size and the pauperization of the population is expanding on a vast scale. 95% of the de facto wealth of the society concentrated in the hands of 1% of our people. And that's why this article in the New York Times about the double whammy from the tax plan says it all. Bill Pound, the executive director of the National Conference of State Legislators, stated that the consequences for states, county, and city throughout the United States will be so devastating that the total social support infrastructure will be wiped out. Phil Angelides, the California's treasurer, stated, "There's no question. This plan will cost the states more. It'll eliminate bonds that benefit the public at a time when our infrastructure is collapsing." And the National Governors Association made a statement in which they said, "The Bush plan will exacerbate a disastrous state fiscal problem to the point of no return." The national economy has left, the New York Times article continues, has left the states and cities reeling. The data compiled by the National Conference of State Legislatures show now that 43 states are operating in the red at a point of collapse. And they are led by California, with the largest shortfall in a half century facing the states in the United States. California has a $34 billion budget gap. $34 billion budget gap. And the article states for 2004, the states in this country are facing their largest shortfall in a half a century, over $85 billion, according to the study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. These financial pressures are moving the states to eliminate almost all social services and health care. And the article reveals that the cities are now begging the states and the federal government for money. But money for what? To cover the cost of security measures since the 9/11 attacks, vaccines, and the Ridge Plan for national security. In short, the city, states, and state governments, under Democrats and Republicans alike, faced with the collapse of the social infrastructure, are begging for money to enhance the police state, the forced vaccination for anthrax and smallpox that will enrich the drug companies while moving us closer to the enforcement condition known as martial law. The article, however, states that the worry of the states and cities is that the 41 states that have personal income tax will now lose state revenues as a result of the federal decision to stop taxing for corporate dividends. That's because the state income tax laws parallel the federal system. So there is here an admission. The New York Times article makes it very clear that this tax plan is going to constitute an all-out war upon the very social support system that represents survival for the unemployed, for the underemployed, for the minimum wage worker, for the bulk of our population and the working class. And the tax systems that the states are going to attempt to increase are regressive. Regressive because they tax working people, they tax the unemployed in precisely the way that they tax the huge corporations.
Well, the biggest regressive tax is the sales tax on everything that you buy except for food. And California, which has a very high tax to begin with, is now what Governor Gray Davis has proposed is an increase of another 1% in the California sales tax. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Now, WBAI is a listener-sponsored radio station, and that means we depend upon you for keeping the station on the air. As a gift to you, we here at Taking Aim have put up an archive of our shows. Some of the not all the shows for the past year are yet up, but shows over the past coming months are up thanks to Mark Bilk and Pamela Summers. You can listen to this archive at www.radio4houston.org/taking aim. And very soon we'll have our own Taking Aim website. But the archive of the shows is up there. So if you want to hear today's show or another show once again, or to download it onto your computer so you can listen to it again and again, please go to that website. Today's show, in their sights, the global class war targeting working people. Now let's look at the specific targeting in California of one sector and in one area, and that is health care for the frail, elderly, and people with disabilities, one of the most vulnerable sectors of the population. Now, health care costs, the mandated costs, federally mandated costs for Medicaid, which is the health care system for the poor, those who would normally not have any health insurance, that takes up 20% to 30% of state budgets with the matching cost to the federal funds that are given to the state, given to the states. And as Ralph had mentioned, California is expected to have a $34.6 billion state budget shortfall. So what does Governor Gray Davis propose to do? He is proposing to slash the Medi-Cal, what's called optional benefits to the seniors and to children and to low-income families, and this particularly will affect the frail elderly. And these services are dental, medical supplies, independent rehabilitation centers, physical therapy, hearing aids, speech and audiology. These are basic services that, particularly for the frail elderly, are very important. Another aspect that he's going to cut, and this may be similar cuts in New York, is who is going to receive services right now in California. If your income is up to 133% of the federal poverty level, you can receive Medi-Cal, and if you need home care, the in-home supportive services, you are then eligible for it. And what Gray Davis is doing is cutting back so that you have to be at the federal poverty level in order to get Medi-Cal in California. This is going to mean thousands and thousands of people are no longer going, of the very poor, the impoverished, are no longer going to have access to medical coverage. Also, what they're doing is reducing the benefit level of Social Security, the SSI, that's given as for people with disabilities, and that's going to be reduced to $708 per month for individuals, or $1,225 per couple, which is a loss of $50 a month. It's not enough money to rent an apartment here in the Bay Area. So as well as this, there have been vast cuts in the home-delivered and congregate meal programs throughout California, eliminating even a surplus food program. So what they are doing is attacking the most vulnerable, slicing away a dollar here, a dollar there. Some of these cuts are a mere $60,000 or $50,000, but taking it away from people who are least able to give political donations to Gray Davis, because that's where he in particular orients the budget.
Maya, Gray Davis, the Democratic governor of California, was the poster boy for the trade union movement and for all those people who looked to the Democrats, the evil lessers, as a supposed alternative to the capitalist depredations of the Republican administrations. No one has been more relentless in driving down the living standards of working people in California, of annihilating their social benefits, of attacking their union organization, than this Democratic governor, Gray Davis, with his Democratic legislature, Senate, and Assembly. And the Los Angeles Times article on December 6th, as the San Francisco article in the San Francisco Chronicle on the the 3rd of February, amplified this. More than one-third of America's employers that offer health care coverage to retired workers have stopped all such benefits for future retirees, and the future retirees can expect that within the next 3 years they will be deprived of all of their savings for health coverage and retirement funding. The report highlights yet another what is called unwelcome consequence of spiraling health care costs at double-digit rates, and it is preparing for what are called tough policy decisions as elected officials confront growing numbers of Americans without health insurance or with health insurance that is being removed. Fewer employers are covering health coverage for their retirees, the article states. 85% of corporations say that they are going to eliminate these protections. Over the past year alone, retiree contributions increased by an average of 20%. A study of 435 corporations revealed that the retired workers and the workers with their health care benefit plans faced their removal. This is across the board. Employers' subsidized health care coverage for retirees is collapsing. Drew Altman, the president of the Kaiser Family Foundation, confirmed it. Randy Johnson, the head of Human Resources Strategic Initiatives from Motorola, Inc., stated, "If we're going to be able to provide jobs to future retirees in an environment of rising costs and global competition, we're going to have money from someplace, or it won't fly." What does that mean? A betrayal of working people who spent a lifetime putting their earnings into retirement plans and pension plans. All of these are being stolen from them. Their life savings, their life work, their future as retired people, their ability to get health coverage and health protection down the toilet. 22% of employees surveyed, more than one in five, have stated that they will terminate health benefits for retirees within the next 3 years. And an additional 13% acknowledge they have stopped all health benefits since for the past 2 years, the Los Angeles Times and San Francisco Chronicle confirm.
Another 1.4 million people last year fell into the ranks of the uninsured, so that in the United States today, 41.2 million people do not have any insurance. Now, you have to remember that there are people who are covered by Medicare, and who are over 65. Medicare does not cover everyone just because you're over 65. Medicare is an insurance program, and people who work have paid into it. So it's not just that you're over 65 that you're going to be covered by Medicare. Then also there are the programs such as Medicaid, of which I was speaking, where many of the states are cutting back. And the federal government just ruled that in terms of emergency services, the states have much more leeway about whether or not they can use Medicaid dollars to give even emergency coverage to the very poor. Now, when people lose their jobs and they lose their health insurance, or even if their company does have health insurance, if they cannot make the copays, which have been increasing, then that is why many people no longer today have any health insurance. And The not being able to pay health insurance bills is still the largest cause of personal bankruptcy in the United States. Now, if you look at someone such as myself who gets insurance as an individual, and even though it's through the National Writers Union, for me alone, the insurance is more than $350 a month, and that's within a health maintenance organization. That's an exorbitant amount, and that's for an individual. For a family, it would be even more. So the attack today is against the people of the United States rather than to the pharmaceutical industry, which is driving up these costs. Most of all, if you talk to the governors of each state, what they will tell you is that it is the cost of pharmaceuticals that is driving up the medical costs, particularly in the Medicare and Medicaid programs. So what do we have here in the United States? Instead of talking about price controls or government ownership of the pharmaceutical industry, instead what we have are pass-throughs of money and subsidies to these very large conglomerates.
Here's how Carolyn Saeed in the San Francisco Chronicle described the crisis. The state health care system is unraveling. It is a health disaster. The head of one of California's largest insurance companies, she wrote on December 4th, 2002 in the San Francisco Chronicle, said yesterday that unless the state provides health coverage for all residents, creating a system that could be, become a model for universal health care, total health care collapse will ensue. That's an extraordinary admission by Bruce Bodakin, the chief executive officer of Blue Shield.
Yes, Ralph, but it's very interesting. He has the correct point that we need universal health coverage, but what Bruce Bodakin wants is that every employer must buy health insurance through the capitalist-owned health insurer.
And that's exactly what the article discloses, that it's rather like the crocodile tears shed by Bush in his State of the Union message when he talks about Medicare or about double taxation and corporate dividends. Bruce Bodakin, on behalf of the insurance company, invokes the necessity for universal health care in order to put forward a scheme in which it will be a profit engine administered by the insurance companies themselves.
And that was the Clinton plan drafted by Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
It was get everybody into health maintenance organizations controlled by the insurance industry.
And the proposal comes, the San Francisco Chronicle reveals, amid a growing belief around the United States that the health care system is in total collapse and in need of radical change. Alarmed, she writes, by spiraling costs and by the vast number of uninsured people, the National Academy of Sciences bluntly told President Bush last month that national and state conditions of health for the people of the United States are in a state of crisis. One in seven Americans, 41 million people, lack health coverage. In California, one in five residents is uninsured, the third highest rate in the nation. Bodakin's idea would require large employers to offer coverage for their employees, exempting smaller firms, and to administer it on a private basis. So universal health care, it is not. It is seeking to invoke the crisis, exploit the crisis, to get state subsidization for the insurance companies to administer a health care program, the costs of which will be exorbitant. It is a con game. And the article continues, many insured people currently wait until their illnesses reach crisis point and are then driven into the emergency room, which drives costs up. 1.7 million of the uninsured who qualify for government programs no longer receive any benefits. And the article states, General Motors would love everybody to be mandated to buy a car, but it's not the best public policy, said Jamie Court, executive director of the Foundation for Taxpayer Payer and Consumer Rights. It is no surprise that a health insurance executive wants a law compelling every citizen to buy his product, but the product will not benefit the people who are paying for it. He's not proposing a Medicare single-payer plan, He's proposing a mandatory plan that keeps the employers in the game while depriving the public of the benefits for which it will be paying.
And across the United States, years ago, as a result of the movement of workers and the unions throughout the United States, there was a vast public health system, including public health clinics and public hospitals. And what's happened today is many of these public hospitals have been closed or decimated so that they're just a shell of the fallback emergency services. And what you have is the pass-through of public monies to private hospitals.
And this is indeed what the San Francisco article series about the healthcare system unraveling exposes, because Sabin Russell, the Chronicle medical writer, following up on the article by Carolyn Said, reveals that a survey by University of California San Francisco researchers warns that California's managed care system is unraveling, as growing numbers of physicians unhappy with low fees refuse to take on new HMO patients, making it harder for even the fully insured to find a doctor at all. 58% of California doctors refuse to accept new patients, including those covered by a health maintenance organization. This means that privately insured HMO patients are having a difficult time to find a doctor. 50% of primary care physicians are no longer accepting Medi-Cal patients, a program notorious for its failure to sustain the care for the most disadvantaged. Quote, patients are feeling the pinch. I had to call 20 doctors on the list to find one that would take me, she said. The doctor I finally found dropped me after 6 months. I have to go through this all over again. HMO members state they have given up trying to find a doctor. My primary care physician gave me a list of 8 physicians, said Marcia Peterson, who is a Blue Shield member. I called each one and is informed they would not take me. They are not taking new patients anymore.
And, Ralph, it's even worse for the people who are on Medi-Cal and Medicaid in other states. In California, for instance, Governor Davis at mid-year cut the Medi-Cal provider rates 5%, and in the next year's budget is proposing cutting it again 10%. Now, this is not just money that goes to doctors. This is money that goes to such agencies as those that provide adult day health, where the frail elderly and people with disabilities have a place to go during the day. But if we look also at the money that goes to the people who are slash and burn the HMO system, Heather Ross, in an article in Generation Women on June 17, 2002, exposed that in 2001, United Health Group CEO William McGuire received a $3.7 million bonus, and his counterpart at Cigna Corporation, H. Howard Hanaway, got a $2.6 million bonus for just how much money they made for their stockholders. Meanwhile, the people are denied benefits.
And Maya, while this is going on, a child is dying of poverty every 50 minutes in the United States. Hundreds of thousands of children are homeless each night. One in five children goes to bed hungry and cold, without heat, without running water, without electricity, in the rat-infested cages that pass for shelter in our inner cities. And the health workers of the world, in crisis mode, worsen in their condition. What about the health conglomerates that we've been describing, and what about their corporate controllers? You mentioned benefits. Richard L. Scott of Columbia HCA received $265 million in 1 year. Peter Nicholson of Boston Scientific Corporation, $231.1 million. David Jones of Humana, Inc., $194.4 million. Leon C. Hirsch of U.S. Surgical Company was paid $105.8 million in 1 year, and that's just the salary. Leonard Abramson of U.S. Healthcare received stock options of $11.4 million, but outright holdings of $783.9 million to that one individual. The total compensation package for Mr. Abramson of U.S. Healthcare, $805,122,000. The total federal spending on AIDS was $1.4 billion, half the value of the stock holdings of the top 10 health industry executive.
Well, that makes the bonuses cited by that I cited in Generation Women seem like a mere pittance. Now, you mentioned the child poverty rate, Ralph, and the National Center for Children in Poverty looked at the state of the children in the United States and how it compared to children in poverty two decades ago. And what's very revealing that the two states that we would consider to be the most advanced in terms of industrial structure and social services, New York and California, are among the highest percentage of child poverty. In California, it's 1 in 4 children, 25.7%, live in poverty. And if we look at Latino, the Hispanics, and the African Americans, it's 1 in 3 in California children live in poverty. And in New York, New York State has the highest child poverty rate in the nation, 26.3%, which again is more than 1 in 4 children live in poverty in New York State. So when you look at the poverty rate for African American children under 6, the very young, the most vulnerable, the rate in the United States is 37%. More than 1 in 3 children live in extremis.
That's why, Maya, the New York Times reports that the U.S. Mayor's report is chronicling rising hunger and homelessness. A record number of citizens in U.S. cities are obliged to look for emergency food and shelter this year, according to the United States Conference on Mayors. Their annual report, the Status Report on Hunger and Homelessness in America, cites the evidence in cities across the United States in 2002, according to the report. The demand for emergency shelter jumped 19%, the largest rise since 1990. In 2001 and 2002, the demand for emergency food increased by 23% and 19% respectively. The calamity that is afflicting working people and the impoverished in the United States is growing by leaps and bounds, quote, in every city, in every county, in every state participating in the survey, there is an increased demand for emergency food. In every city, emergency food systems facilities were relied upon by families and individuals are being eliminated by state, county, and city budget cuts. Families with children made up 54% of those requiring emergency food assistance in Miami, 95% in Charlotte, North Carolina, 70 and 80% respectively of emergency food applicants in Los Angeles and in Philadelphia, Miami, with a 50% increase in demand for emergency food, a 50% increase in demand by families for food assistance in 2002. In Minnesota, the food banks served 900,000 individuals in 300,000 households in 2001. By the third quarter of 2002, over 1 million individuals in 325 households. It is a national crisis. It is a national disaster. It is class war on the most vulnerable of our people. Our working people, our poor people are being devastated in this society as war and devastation across the planet are the priority for a degenerate capitalist system. Republican or Democrat, whatever the politician, the agenda is the same.
Now, Ralph, when we talk about poor children and people living near poverty and the homeless, it's important to note, as the Center for the National Center for Children in Poverty made reference in their statistics, most children have at least one employed parent. Now, let's look at this. Most of the working poor, most of the people in the United States who are poor are working poor. And those living near poverty, which are 39%, 4 out of 10 American children living near poverty, that means below 200% of the poverty line, that's for a family of three, less than $26,580, are people who are working. Working. And what does President Bush offer as a solution? Tax cuts to the rich, war against the people of the world, and also voluntarism. Let's look at the study that was done by charities Almost half of charitable donations in the United States go to churches and religious institutions to pay for their administrative costs and for religious education. It does not go to help the poor. 90% of charity funds are collected locally and spent locally, but not on the poor. Only 10% of charitable donations in the United States today go to the poor. The rich give to fund projects that benefit themselves, be it the symphony, the ballet, or hospitals that serve them, not public hospitals. So when President Bush talks about volunteerism, he isn't talking about what is really going to aid the impoverished and the working poor of this country.
That is the gravamen of the reports that we have been citing. Quote, it is remarkable that over the last decade alone, the percent of the homeless population consisting of families with children has climbed from 32% to over 40%. Two-thirds of the U.S. homeless population consists of families with children of single women and unaccompanied youth. One in five of the homeless are working in full-time jobs that do not pay enough to rent an apartment, and people are now remaining homeless for as long as 6 months. Four out of five of the cities stated that the length of time people are homeless has increased by 100% in the past year. It is a calamity, brothers and sisters, a disaster for working people, the consequences of capitalist rule.
You are listening to Taking Aim. Today, our program has been in their sights, the global class war targeting working people. You can listen to Taking Aim after today on the internet at www.radioforhouston.org/takingaim. You can contact us at 212-209-2953 or at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.
Wednesday, Colin Powell will present to the UN Security Council a declaration of war against Iraq. Now's the time for anyone and everyone